The Savior, predicting events to occur just before His second coming, says, "For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible they shall deceive the very elect." Here again are wonders foretold, wrought for the purpose of deception, so powerful that were it possible, even the very elect would be deceived by them. Thus we have a prophecy, and there are many others, setting forth the development in the last days of a wonder-working power, manifested to a startling and unprecedented degree in the interest of falsehood and error. The earthly government with which it was to be especially connected is that represented by the two-horned beast or false prophet. The agency lying back of the outward manifestations was to be satanic, the spirit of devils. The prophecy calls for such a work as this in America at the present time. Do we behold anything like it? Read the answer in the lamentation of the prophet: "Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time." Stand aghast, O earth, tremble ye people, but be not deceived. The huge specter of evil confronts us, as the prophet declared. Satan is loosed. From the depth of Tartarus, myriads of demons swarm over the land. The prince of darkness manifests himself as never before, and throwing over his work a would-be heavenly garb, he calls it spiritualism. Number 1. Does spiritualism then bear the marks of satanic agency? A. The spirits which communicate claim to be the spirits of our departed friends, but the Bible in the most explicit terms assures us that the dead are wholly inactive and unconscious till the resurrection. That the dead know not anything, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 5. That every operation of the mind has ceased, Psalm 146, 4. That every emotion of the heart is suspended, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 6. And that there is neither work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where they lie, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, verse 10. Whatever intelligence, therefore, comes to us professing to be one of our dead friends, comes claiming to be what, from the Word of God, we know he is not. But angels of God do not lie. Therefore, these are not the good angels. Spirits of devils will lie. This is their work. And these are the credentials which at the very outset they hand us. B. The doctrines which they teach are also directly contrary to the Bible. They deny God. They deny Christ. They deny the atonement. They deny the Bible. They deny the existence of sin and all distinction between right and wrong. They deny the sacredness of the marriage covenant, and interspersing their utterances with blasphemies against God and His Son, and everything that is lovely and good and pure, they give the freest license to every propensity to sin, and to every carnal and fleshly lust. Tell us not that these things openly taught under the garb of religion, and backed up by supernatural sights and sounds, are anything less than Satan's masterpiece. For proof that these charges are none too severe, see spiritualism a subject of prophecy, containing quotations from their own writings. Review and Herald Publishing House, Battle Creek, Michigan. Number 2. Spiritualism answers accurately to the prophecy in the exhibition of great signs and wonders. Among its many achievements, these may be mentioned. Various articles have been transported from place to place by spirits alone. Beautiful music has been produced independent of human agency, with and without the aid of visible instruments. Many well-attested cases of healing have been presented. Persons have been carried through the air by the spirits in the presence of many others. Tables have been suspended in the air, with several persons upon them. And finally, spirits have presented themselves in bodily form and talked with an audible voice. Number 3. Spiritualism answers to the prophecy in that it had its origin in the United States. thus connecting its wonders with the work of the two-horned beast. Commencing in Hydesville, New York, in the family of Mr. John D. Fox, in the latter part of March, 1848, it spread with incredible rapidity through all the world. A letter to the writer from a leading spiritualist publisher, December 1895, claims 5 million believers in the United States and 50 million throughout the world. Of those who have become its devotees, Judge Edmonds said as long ago as 1853, "Besides the undistinguished multitude, there are many now of high standing and talent ranked among them, doctors, lawyers, and clergymen in great numbers, a Protestant bishop, the learned and reverend president of a college, judges of our higher courts, members of Congress, foreign ambassadors, and ex-members of the United States Senate." The foregoing statement was written many years ago. From that time to this, the work of the spirits has been steadily progressing and spreading among all classes of people. One reason why it is now difficult to estimate the number of those who might properly be denominated spiritualists is that the more prominent and respectable of the adherents of this movement are drawing under cover the obnoxious and immoral features of the system, heretofore so prominent, and assuming a Christian garb. By this move, they bring themselves and a multitude of church members upon common ground, where there is no distinction between them in fact, though there still may be in name, the latter still remaining with their various denominations. A little work by Hudson Tuttle, What is Spiritualism?, page 6, gives a list of 22 emperors, queens, princes, and members of the nobility who have through spiritualism sought counsel in their affairs, or favored and supported its claims. It is thus preparing to fulfill Revelation chapter 16, verse 14, and gather the nations to the battle of the great day. Number 11. An Image to the Beast. Closely associated with this working of miracles is the erection of an image to the beast. The prophet thus connects the two in verse 14. "And deceiveth them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast, saying to them that dwell on the earth that they should make an image to the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live." The deception accomplished by the working of the miracles prepares the way for compliance with this demand for the formation of an image to the beast. To understand what would be an image of the papacy, we must first gain some definite idea of what constitutes the papacy itself. The full development of the beast, or the establishment of papal supremacy, dates from the famous letter of Justinian, which was made effective in AD 538, constituting the Pope the head of the Church and the corrector of heretics. The papacy was a church clothed with civil power, an ecclesiastical body having authority to punish all dissenters with confiscation of goods, imprisonment, torture, and death. What would be an image of the papacy? Another ecclesiastical establishment clothed with similar power. How could such an image be formed in the United States? Let the Protestant churches be clothed with power to define and punish heresy, to enforce their dogmas under the pains and penalties of the civil law, and should we not have an exact representation of the papacy during the days of its supremacy? It may be objected that whereas the papal church was comparatively a unit, and hence could act in harmony in all its departments in enforcing its dogmas, the Protestant church is so divided as to be unable to agree in regard to what doctrines shall be made imperative on the people. The answer is, there are certain points which they hold in common, and which are sufficient to form a basis of cooperation. Chief among these may be mentioned the doctrine of the conscious state of the dead and the immortality of the soul, which is both the foundation and superstructure of spiritualism, and also the doctrine that the first day of the week is the Christian Sabbath. Let now an ecclesiastical organization be formed by these churches. Let the government legalize such organization and give it power, a power which it will not have to till the government does grant it, to enforce upon the people the dogmas which the different denominations can all adopt as the basis of union. And what do we have? Just what the prophecy represents, an image to the papal beast, endowed with life by the two-horned beast, to speak and act with power. And are there any indications of such a movement? The preliminary question, that of the grand union of all the churches, is now profoundly agitating the religious world. Charles Beecher, in his sermon at the dedication of the Second Presbyterian Church, Fort Wayne, Indiana, February 22, 1846, before referred to, said, "Thus are the ministry of the evangelical Protestant denominations not only formed all the way up under a tremendous pressure of merely human fear, but they live and move and breathe in a state of things radically corrupt and appealing in every hour to every baser element of their nature to hush up the truth and bow the knee to the power of apostasy. Was not this the way things went with Rome? Are we not living her life over again? And what do we see just ahead? Another general council, a world's convention, evangelical alliance, and universal creed." The Banner of Light, July 30, 1864, said, "A system will be unfolded sooner or later that will embrace in its folds church and state, for the object of the two should be one and the same." The Church Advocate in March 1870, speaking of the formation of an independent American Catholic Church, a movement now agitated in this country, said, "There is evidently some secret power at work, which may be preparing the world for great events in the near future." A Mr. Havens, in a speech delivered in New York a few years ago, said, "For my own part, I wait to see the day when a Luther shall spring up in this country, who shall found a great American Catholic Church instead of a great Roman Catholic Church, and who shall teach men that they can be good Catholics without professing allegiance to a pontiff on the other side of the Atlantic." In favor of this union, or rather confederacy of churches, journals are published and speakers are pleading today. Thus there are indications that at no distant day such a church will be seen, not indeed raised up through the instrumentality of a Luther, but rather through the operation of the same spirit that inspired a Fernando Nunez or a Torquemada. This being done, another installment of the prophecy will be accomplished, and the image will be formed, and inasmuch as the United States is the only country where such a move can be looked for, and as events are here openly tending to such a result, the evidence is hereby still further strengthened that the prophecy applies to this government. Number 12. The Mark of the Beast. The two-horned beast enforces upon its subjects the mark of the first beast. We have now in the prophecy three agents introduced, which we must carefully distinguish from one another to avoid confusion. Number 1. The papal beast. This power is designated as the beast, the first beast, the beast which had the wound by a sword and did live, and the beast whose deadly wound was healed. These expressions all refer to the same power, and wherever they occur in this prophecy, they have exclusive reference to the papacy. Number 2. The two-horned beast. This power, after its introduction in verse 11 of chapter 13, is represented through the remainder of the prophecy by the pronoun he, and wherever this pronoun occurs, down to the 17th verse, with possibly the exception of the 16th verse, which perhaps may refer to the image, it refers invariably to the two-horned beast. Number 3. The image of the beast. This is every time, with a possible but not probable exception just stated, called the image, so that there is no danger of confounding this with any other agent. The acts ascribed to the image are speaking and enforcing the worship of itself under the penalty of death, and this is the only enactment which the prophecy mentions as enforced under the penalty of death. The mark of the beast is enforced by the two-horned beast, either directly or through the image. The penalty attached to a refusal to receive this mark is a forfeiture of all social privileges, a deprivation of the right to buy and sell. The mark is the mark of the papal beast. Against this worship of the beast and his image and the reception of his mark, the third angel's message of Revelation chapter 14, verses 9 to 12, is a most solemn and thrilling warning.